Welcome. This is William Evans, and you are listening to Shifting Gears. Our guest today is Tyler Lindsay, born here in the Roaring Fork Valley and currently residing in Aspen. Welcome, Tyler.
Thanks, Will. It's funny, actually, I would say I reside in Woody Creek, because sometimes to say you reside in Aspen is embarrassing.
Oh, well, we would avoid embarrassing you unnecessarily. Kindly tell us your age and a little bit about who you are.
Sure. So I'm 38 years old. I have lived here in the Roaring Fork Valley just about my entire life, except for a few years up in the Pacific Northwest for college. And, you know, I feel like I've been fortunate to attend a whole bunch of different schools in the Valley, be a part of a number of different interesting communities here in the Valley. And, you know, really, really view myself as a product of this place.
Beautiful. What can you tell us about your relationship with water?
Well, you know, I have the same relationship that all humans have with water, in that I am made mostly of it. But then I also have a pretty deep relationship with water through my longstanding snowboarding practice. Increasingly, I've gotten interested in gardening, and water is a pretty critical component of that process as well.
Right. So talk about your respect for water.
Well, so, you know, living where we do at largely the headwaters of the West, I think there's a lot of opportunity around water. And with that opportunity and that access to abundance of water, there's also a lot of responsibility.
What can you tell us about water quantity?
You know, this year is a fairly exceptional year in terms of water quantity. When you look at the rivers and the watersheds around us, they're really full. They appear really healthy. When you look into the high country, it's a lot more green than it has been in years past. I'm sure, you know, this is an audience that remembers the contrast with the 2018 summer and how dry it was and how scary it was to have Basalt Mountain burning. And so, you know, in consideration of our relationship to water, I think that really illustrates just how critical it is to, you know, human survival and flourishing and broader environmental flourishing.
Right. And where we live, quantity is directly related to snowfall.
Yes. And you know, as we know, this was a fairly exceptional winter when it comes to snowfall.
What can you tell us about water quality?
I think the simplest measure of water quality is a measure of purity. You want your water to be as free from, you know, chemical or particulate pollution as is possible. And so, you know, going back to that idea that living here at the headwaters of the West, we have a lot of responsibility around that water. What I mean by that more specifically is that our choices around water have an impact that telegraphs across many thousands of square miles and many millions of human lives.
Are you content with the water quality as far as you know?
You know, in my home, I feel pretty content. We've got, you know, I live in an employee housing neighborhood up at W/J, and we have a shared community well. And, you know, the notion of sharing water with my neighbors feels good to me. You know, I suppose you could always ask questions about how it's treated and, you know, how much chlorine or other purification tools or contaminants, depending on your perspective, are in that water. But yeah, I think broadly, I do feel good about the water that I drink and use every day.
And when we spoke before, on a panoramic view, you had a sense about what people are seeking and how they organize their elective energy. What do you think they're seeking?
Well, I think broadly they're seeking states of consciousness. You know, they're seeking to enjoy more desirable states of consciousness, love, excitement, happiness, contentedness, etc. And broadly, they're trying to avoid states of consciousness that would be perceived on the more negative side of the spectrum, you know, anger, sadness, contentiousness, competition, etc. And, you know, I think that one of the things that I said when we spoke the other day is that, you know, largely these states are drug mediated, whether sort of your endogenous neurotransmitters or exogenous equivalents.
It'd be helpful for you to kind of give us a perspective of what you mean by drug mediated.
Sure. So, you know, I mentioned earlier that I have a deep and long snowboard practice. And it wasn't until I was many years into that practice that I sort of came to this realization that the main thing that I seek in such a, you know, lengthy engagement with it is what could broadly be termed a flow state. And just a little bit of background on kind of the flow state stuff. This was popularized in a really excellent book by Stephen Kotler called The Rise of Superman. And then in a subsequent book that he co-authored with this guy, Jamie Wheel, called Stealing Fire. But their work builds on the work of a Polish psychologist named Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi, who kind of first identified the flow state. And, you know, Csikszentmihalyi basically called it the optimum state of human consciousness, when your actions flow from one to the next without much conscious decision making between them. And those actions are, you know, really optimized for the state that you find yourself in. And so Kotler and Wheel sort of undertook this multi-year project to that they referred to as the Flow Genome Project, where they tried to identify how this happens, what the cycle is around it, and how we might try and replicate that state or have access to it more often, since it is such a state of flourishing. So anyway, one of the things that I learned from these studies of flow states is that when you're in a flow state, you're basically enjoying a cocktail of five of the most potent neurotransmitters. Or, you know, in other words, your kind of naturally produced hormones. So, and you're enjoying them all at once. So, you know, among those five, you have norepinephrine, more commonly known as adrenaline, which has an exogenous equivalent in kind of the speed family of drugs. You have dopamine, which is, you know, broadly a pleasure chemical. And cocaine, for example, works on your dopaminergic system. You have quite a bit of serotonin when you're in the flow state. The psychedelic family of drugs operates on your serotonergic system. You have anandamide, which is a cannabinoid. And I think here in Colorado, we're fairly familiar with the exogenous cannabinoids. And I'm forgetting the fifth, but you know, that is to say, like, these most pleasurable...
Well, so is the fifth oxytocin?
I believe it is, yeah.
And oxytocin is love.
Correct, yeah.
Intimacy. Cuddling.
Yeah, a sense of deep connection with, you know, I would say that the people that I go snowboarding with are some of the closest relationships in my life, even if a lot of those relationships aren't like deep intellectual relationships. We share a deep understanding on a embodied level.
In the flow, the quality of water within you and the endogenous hormonal system that's active is in some kind of a resonance with the life-sustaining qualities of Mother Earth and Father Sky.
Certainly, yeah. I mean, you know, the best days on your snowboard are the days where, you know, you've gotten a huge influx of water in, you know, frozen flake form. And you get to really dance with it in a... I guess it enables... for lack of a better word, your superpowers.
So I think it would be helpful for you to clarify for our listeners, how much of the time are you running on your own endocrine system and how much of the time are you supplementing it with exogenous sources of various chemicals?
Sure. Well, I drink coffee every day in the morning.
Yeah.
I have a more than passing familiarity with the cannabinoids, you know, in terms of how often. I would say, you know, I'm not smoking pot every day, but I am engaging with nature every day. And there is a, you know, a real sense that like one thing that seems to work to kick you into sustained flow outside of an athletic context is to, you know, have some coffee, do just enough exercise that you're, oh, endorphins. That was the fifth, actually, not oxytocin. Endogenous morphine, in other words. So anyway, a bit of caffeine, a bit of endorphins, and either a natural or exogenous cannabinoid is a fairly reliable trigger for that creative flow.
Okay, so we're interested a lot in this conversation about the basal state, and you're an adult, so you can manage your exogenous supplements as you see fit. Have you always had a strong connection with nature?
Oh, for sure. Yeah, I mean, I would say, you know, both in my family setting and in almost the entirety of my formal education, engagement with nature has been an important part of that.
So maybe say a little bit more about what happened to you in the outdoor ed program in high school.
Well, it actually, my first, you know, programmatic access to the outdoors was actually in middle school at the Aspen Community School.
Right.
But the biggest lesson that I take broadly from time in the outdoors is a sense of pace that's more appropriate than maybe the incredibly fast pace that our modern civilization provides, and then also a sense of cyclicality or, you know, the way that nature cycles.
So you get into a rhythm that's in sync. You're in flow with Mother Nature.
Yes. You know, that's a big part of what 30 years of being a snowboarder has taught me as well, which is a sense of familiarity with what one can broadly expect at different points of the year. November and December tend to be my least favorite months because it's cold and muddy and the mountain biking isn't as much fun, but it hasn't yet snowed enough to you know, snowboard at the level that really draws out my best self. You head into February and March. That tends to be our most reliable months in terms of snow. And, you know, I think there's these moments during a great powder day where you feel like the life contained inside of you is more than can fit in the small scale of your human body. And it just comes pouring out of you in every direction. And you know, these are really some of the most pleasurable moments of life. I sense some recognition in your laugh.
Well, yes. I have lovely memories of that relationship with powder. So have you ever gotten to a location where you felt safe drinking directly from a spring or a stream?
Sure, yeah.
And did you notice anything with that?
It's hard to identify because, like, there is an undeniable positivity or safety that is associated with it, but it's hard to describe because it's very subtle. You know, the difference is in drinking, you know, pure snow melt that, you know, you can visually draw a line between, you know, it melting as clean snow and it appearing in as flowing water. You know, you can actually see this. And so there's a sense of safety and trust and completeness with it. But again, it's a very subtle sense in comparison to drinking a glass of water from the tap.
Yeah, you might have to be listening at a very quiet level.
Mm, I'm not very good at that.
So you'd mentioned before that you've also noticed the influence of electronics on your state of being.
Oh, sure, yeah. You know, the electronics are probably only the newest and the most potent manifestation, but there is a broad sense that our civilization is really good at producing hypernormal stimuli.
What do you mean by hypernormal?
So, you know, hypernormal is obviously existing in contrast with normal. And in this case, I would say that normal is, broadly speaking, what, you know, humans would likely have experienced in their ancestral environment. So we have in our diet here in the United States, for example, a hypernormal access to sugar. You know, in an ancestral context, you might get sugar once or twice a year when the fruit is ripe, when the berries are ripe, and this takes place on a, you know, cyclical level. And even then, you're consuming that sugar with a huge amount of fiber to kind of like moderate the digestive pace. You might sit and see a flickering fire for hours at a time, and that would be considered a normal stimuli in an ancestral environment. When you scroll through your Instagram feed, you are basically awash in the wildest moments of people's lives for, you know, the entire time that you're scrolling through. And so, you know, that's not normal. That's hypernormal. Mm. Same goes for, you know, television advertisements or neon lights in Las Vegas. There's a set of environmental stimuli that we evolved to cope with, and then all around us are these sets of far greater than normal stimuli.
But so let me ask you a question. Is a day in deep powder hypernormal?
Internally it is. Yeah.
I would call that an ecstatic state. But I don't think I've ever had an ecstatic experience with my computer.
One of the things that people in my sport community do a lot of is capturing their experiences in a way that attempts to convey that ecstasy through electronic mediation.
Okay.
I could show you a great library of such things. That's what the X Games does, broadly speaking.
Okay.
Is try to convey those ecstatic states through electronic mediation to varying degrees of success.
Yeah. Well, that's helpful for me to understand about what you young kids are doing.
You know, and the technology for it gets better and better. So for example, this week in my job at the Aspen Skiing Company, I spent some time in the mountain bike park with a high-speed, tiny racing drone. And the pilot of this drone puts on a pair of goggles, and so his visual field is entirely composed of the visual field of the camera on his tiny buzzing aircraft. And then he chased me and some other friends who are better bikers than me down the trails in the Snowmass Bike Park. And when you watch that, it brings you back to, you know, 80% of the feeling of actually doing it.
Huh, I think that might be helpful for me to get to see.
I'll pull it up on my phone for you if you like.
Okay. This is KDNK. You're listening to a conversation with Tyler Lindsay. We're talking about water quality and the connection between inner and outer water quality. Talk to me about balance.
So there's, you know, obviously in so many of the sports that I've been referencing in this conversation, balance is a pretty critical component. And a complex relationship with balance is a crucial part of that, of success in doing these, you know, nominally dangerous things and mitigating the risk of them.
And balance is fun, and not being in balance is various grades of catastrophe.
Well, not being in balance, but then recovering your balance is fun.
And that happens all the time.
Yeah, it's constant. Yeah, there's a, you know, the calculations that we are able to do without even realizing that we're making these calculations are, you know, they remain well ahead of what any of our computers or robots are capable of, that's for sure.
A failure in balance is messy in many of the activities you're talking about.
For sure.
Failure in a balance of a culture and its relationship with water is messy.
Indeed, yeah. I think, you know, it's clear that a relationship with water that goes sufficiently out of balance is catastrophic for a society or a civilization. And this is something I was actually thinking about while I was driving down this afternoon, so forgive me if this feels like a non sequitur, but you know, I was kind of reflecting on the fact that collapse of civilization or society seems to be the rule rather than the exception. It's much more common for societies to fail than it is for them to sustain in historical terms. You know, obviously there are civilizations that have lasted a very long time.
Give us a couple of examples of ones you think of that have successfully sustained themselves a long time.
You know, they would tend to be very small-scale tribal societies.
So examples that we might be familiar with would be the Hopi.
Sure.
The Pueblo people. The pre-Pueblo people were at Chaco Canyon. And when the drought came, they successfully reinvented themselves. And it was an interesting process because the farmers, who were the life-sustaining component of that culture, just walked away. Mm. And many of them walked to the Rio Grande and regrouped and reorganized and avoided creating an elite culture that wanted to build great houses when things were collapsing.
Right. And I think that's the historical pattern that has allowed for success, right? Is you know, kind of you could call it expansion to new territory.
Yeah, but it's a very small number of cultures that do that. You know, the Assyrians and the Babylonians and the Inca haven't done that so far.
No, you know, and nor did the Romans or the Greeks or the British Empire, you know, you could say experienced a form of collapse.
Right, and particularly Greece devastated their forests building warships.
That's correct, yeah. So so anyway, there's a few different directions you could go from that jumping off point, but the Greeks did indeed exhaust their forests trying to build warships, and that speaks to, you know, the common. Well, actually, let me first say that. Sorry, this is hard for me to articulate well.
Take your time.
Given that collapse seems to be much more common than successfully navigating these transitions, one of the things that we really have to keep in mind as being unique to the current moment of the threat of collapse, which feels very real. The thing that's unique now is that this is the first time the entire planet has been wrapped up into a single civilization. So when Rome collapses, this is problematic if you live in Rome. But if you are living in a pueblo in southwestern Colorado during that collapse, you would have no idea that it occurred. And, you know, when the walkaway people were able to walk away to the Rio Grande, that's because the Rio Grande was separate from that civilization. And we don't have that luxury of separation anymore. It's a single system now. It's a single global economy.
The interconnection is as interconnected as our water system.
Mm.
Thank you, Tyler.
Great. Thank you for having me, Will. This was really fun.
Yeah, I have a feeling we might want to continue and